There was supposed to be a voice there saying that this was Booktown and you could get anything you want here and anything you need. And even though that voice didn't appear, it is Booktown and you can get anything you want here and anything you need, especially today if you need some good information on the interaction of the world ecology and what we have been in the habit of calling an economy, though I can hardly believe that. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. I have two interviews today on those topics. First one that I recorded about 2 weeks ago with Raj Patel. His book is The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. And in the second half of the program, I'll be talking with Matt Roney, who's a research staffer for the Earth Policy Institute, organization headed by Lester Brown. Their publications include Eco Economy and what they've been coming out with for the last couple of years, Plan B, which has gone now into four editions. We've got Plan B 4.0, and that's the main thing we'll talk about. With Raj Patel, I talked to him actually right in the middle of the Copenhagen so-called Global Climate Change Conference, which produced woefully little. So we don't have any afterthoughts on that, but we do have a lot of interesting interchanges, I think, about what economics is, how it's been defined, how we've come to think of people in certain economic terms and ignored all the others. This is more or less stating the problem, and in the second half with Matt Roney, we'll be getting at some possible solutions. So here is my conversation with Raj Patel.
I found your book so fascinating, partly because it finally stated a bunch of ideas which I've had kind of vague in my mind, and I thought, well, maybe I'll have to develop these. Maybe I have to write the book. But you did it so well that you got me off the hook.
You're very kind, Eric.
In particular, there's the whole idea of how modern economics and how the idea of market economies has developed, and you say quite clearly that these are not traditional markets, what we deal with today, and the economic system we deal with today is not the way people traditionally exchanged goods. And you do a fascinating job of describing how it developed. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about how the what we call the market economy and the whole idea of economics came about.
That's hard to do in a few sentences, but in essence, of course, societies around the world and throughout time have had markets, have had this idea that through some medium of exchange, people can haggle for things between different geographical areas, that you don't have to rely on bartering, but it is possible through certain kinds of interaction to figure out other ways of exchanging things. But what we've got today is a very strange form, a very strange mutation of that, where essentially markets become ways for powerful corporations and powerful people to live beyond their means and to live to escape the consequences of their actions. In other words, markets, and particularly modern market capitalism, becomes a way not only of exploiting people but also the environment, and also then through which prices don't reflect the full value of things. Markets become a way of practicing a certain kind of chicanery around what the true value of things should actually be. If you look at the history of economics, Aristotle had this very interesting distinction between kresmatics and economics. Economics is meant to be the study of how to provide and distribute for the home. But kresmatics is the study of how market prices become what they are. And what we've seen is that modern kinds of economics are really about prices and not about a more thoughtful way of thinking about how distribution should work. And that we've lost that original understanding that there's a distributional component to understanding how resources should be allocated that aren't about prices, but are about other kinds of priorities.
And you point out very strongly that in concentrating on prices, there's a strong impetus to disregard all externalities, all things which the company or the individual doesn't have to pay for themselves, and leave those to the rest of society, and that makes the prices we've got totally artificial.
Absolutely. We've managed in rich countries to consume way beyond our means, and in order to do that, we've effectively run up an ecological debt against the environment and the people of poor countries. And if you count just along five simple axes in terms of deforestation and agricultural intensification, climate change, ozone, and water depletion, and overfishing, rather. If you add up the full debt of the way that we've consumed in rich countries against poor countries, you'll find that we owe poor countries $5 trillion over the past 40 years. And that's a debt that we've managed to shuffle off onto poor countries, and which, unless we face our responsibilities, they will continue to bear the burden of.
Now, how did we come to get this form of thinking? A lot of people trace it back to Adam Smith and his Wealth of Nations, which was written 2 1/4 centuries ago, but he actually doesn't propound these sorts of ideas.
No, and I think that's the interesting thing, that sort of Adam Smith becomes a sort of poster child for the free market, and he was famously on the neckties of the Reagan administration, because the Reagan administration's experiments in free market economics were unprecedented, but they needed a veneer of respectability, and they used the works of Adam Smith. But Adam Smith understood that while the free market had its role, there were some inherent dangers in it, and among those dangers were the tendencies of corporations to go off the rails, and also of a certain class of people to start running the show in a way that eventually distorted that market and distorted the way in which the market and society's interests were aligned. So Adam Smith certainly thought that there were some things about the market that worked quite well in terms of a division of labor, for example. But he was cautious about letting the market rule everything. I mean, he thought that the governments had a really important role to play, for example, in terms of education, in terms of reeling in the excesses of the market and leveling the playing field, as it were, particularly for workers. And that understanding of where markets have limits has sort of been eroded away, and sometimes very consciously. By more contemporary thinkers and by policymakers. I mean, most famously, of course, Alan Greenspan, who is a sort of almost a caricature of a sort of free marketeer. And he was a sort of disciple of Ayn Rand, the ultimate sort of libertarian free marketeer, who nonetheless joined the government and proceeded to bring his philosophy to life. And it was very interesting to see just a few months ago, Alan Greenspan in front of Congress, in front of Henry Waxman, having to eat crow and to take back his philosophy and admit that there was a flaw in his ideology that had governed the way that he thought the way the world worked, and that he was having to reappraise the way that he thinks.
Well, Adam Smith, in addition to being sort of the founder of modern economics, was also a moral philosopher, and he, in his moral philosophy, put a lot of emphasis on empathy from one person to another and how we feel obligations to one another. Somehow that got derailed into the idea that economic man should only consider profit. How did that happen?
Well, again, it started off as a sort of simplification. I mean, when John Stuart Mill, for example, invented the idea of economic man, he used it as a way of getting to truth through social science. And economic man was a sort of simplifying device to help analyze the world in a particular way. Mill himself, of course, was also an advocate for a great deal of social justice, and in fact, towards the end of his life, ended up subscribing to various kinds of distributional socialism that looked very different from the understanding that we have now of economic man being an agent through whose selfish behavior the best of all possible worlds will emerge. And essentially, I mean, this idea of economic man and the idea that we should only attend to our selfish interests in order to get to bring about a better society. Well, that's an idea that's been hijacked mainly by some very rich people and the people who do their thinking for them, in order to justify a world where social justice means very little, to justify a world where redistribution, fairness, a range of other concerns that are vital to us as human beings get erased, and instead we get turned into these sort of one-dimensional creatures who are essentially driven by the idea of want and greed, and somehow those wants and greeds are above all what characterize us as animals, as human beings. And I think that what we're seeing today in more and more research is an efflorescence of an understanding that we are not merely greedy creatures. I mean, there is this sort of fundamental idea that at the end of the day, we are all selfish, and we will look only to ourselves. But a great deal of research throughout history has shown that we are innately cooperative animals. I mean, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was very interested in the behavior of primates, and he used it to model the idea of how human beings can be socialized, and that we can, I mean, although he had a very dim view of the way human beings are, and Rousseau thought that essentially, you know, we aren't terribly good to one another, but we can learn, and we can be educated, and we can become better people through education. And that, you know, that idea is intrinsically, you know, although we have the capacity to be fairly monstrous, we also have innately the capacity to be cooperative and to work together. Well, that's being shown again and again in successive experiments in behavioral economics, in psychology, and primatology, that show us that we aren't just these selfish creatures of want and greed, but that we are hardwired to be cooperative. And that when we are cooperative, we actually end up being happier. I mean, there's now a lot of findings in the study of happiness that shows that we are happiest when we, you know, when we're generous, when we give things away, rather than when we accumulate and when we are greedy.
You devote several pages to the University of Chicago economist Gary Becker, whose economic approach to human behavior claimed that the economic approach provides a useful framework for understanding all human behavior. But then on the next page, when he's talking about how he got into economics, he said, "I contemplated transferring to sociology, but found the subject too difficult." It's almost as if he couldn't deal with all the ambiguity and variety of human behavior and just had to narrow it down to one or two impulses.
Yes, and I think it's interesting that now Gary Becker's idea of all the world's a market and we can model the world by assuming that human beings are rational actors, and in cases where we can't model that, we should be modeling that, and our policy should essentially treat the whole world as market and as a market, and we will maximize social benefit by treating individuals as economic agents. You know, that's the world that he's sort of advocating. And so you end up with some fairly monstrous conclusions. He suggests that for example, bigamy and polygamy is economically more efficient, because if you can't, in a world where the point of getting married is for women to be able to accumulate money, then for those women who are not able to find a husband, right off the bat, that having the opportunity to be a second wife will increase their welfare. And this is the kind of monstrous conclusion that he comes up with. And he also advocates auctioning off citizenship rights, so that the right sort of citizen who is rich and motivated will be allowed to enter a country, whereas giving citizenship away for free will allow the lower, the less desirable kinds of people to come in. I mean, these are the sorts of ideas that Gary Becker would like to see made real, to see markets prevail everywhere. Now, of course, the irony is that this kind of thinking, this kind of rational, market-driven kind of approach, is now hegemonic in sociology. I mean, at the time that Gary Becker was trying to become a sociologist, there were more subtle ways of thinking. And a lot of sociology has today adopted many of the sort of economics ideas. Because in large part, there's a strong push in the social sciences, particularly in the United States, to ape economics, which in turn is trying to ape certain kinds of aspirations towards physics and the natural sciences. But the interesting thing is that the economics, the sort of cutting edge social science and rational choice theories of today, are using the mathematics of 150 years ago, when the basic sort of tenets of economics and economic analysis and marginal analysis were put in place. The marginalists 150 years ago were basically just copying what at the time seemed to be cutting edge physics. And so the irony is that the cutting edge social science today is based on premises 150 years old from a completely different set of sciences.
So is it fair to say that modern economics is not really a science, but I would call it an ideology?
Well, I mean, in terms of sort of provable hypotheses and testability, economics leaves a great deal wanting. The standard joke is that in a room full of N economists, there'll always be N plus one opinions. I certainly think that if you follow the evolution of economics over time, it mirrors changing shifts in power and in the possibilities of politics much more than can be explained simply through the unfolding of a science. So yes, absolutely. I think that there's always been a very strong ideological component to the way that the economic system and the rules that we put in place to explain and understand it. And that's become particularly clear recently with the recession and the collapse of what we were once told were unshakable economic laws.
And it also strikes me that it could maybe be a science if there were some free markets that could be studied objectively. But if you look around at the markets in the world, I don't see any of them being really free. Some players have much more power than others.
Well, I think that that's fundamental observation. It's certainly true that we can have sort of experiments with free markets that involve undergraduate students at universities, and we can watch their behavior and see what they do or don't do. But if you look at the world today, and if you look at the way that markets are structured, what you see is not the sort of mathematical wet dream of perfect competition, where there are large numbers of producers and large numbers of consumers, and there is perfect information, and everyone can enter or exit the market as they like. But you see a great deal of concentration of market power. You see asymmetries in information. You see a range of things that make this, the ideal of a free market very, very far from where we are today, and we're drifting even further as market power becomes increasingly concentrated in the hands of a few.
You use the metaphor of Anton's blindness, a medical syndrome in which people who have been deprived of their sight still think they can see.
Yeah, I think that firstly, Anton's blindness is intrinsically interesting. Imagine that you are in fact blind, but you profess, you insist that you can see. And in fact, when the neurologists diagnose the condition, one of the ways that they diagnose the condition is when people who are in fact blind but believe they can see, they bump into things. And then they will make up a story about why they bumped into something because they just didn't know it was there, rather than in fact they are blind. And this is called confabulation. And this kind of confabulation is, I think, sort of explains, or rather, it's a symptom of how we behave today when it comes to markets. Because markets patently don't reflect the value of things. And yet, because we've lost any other understanding or any other appreciation of the way that we might value things as part of an outcome of collective decision-making, for example. And the only way that we can value things, apparently, is through prices. But when prices go horribly wrong, we're left confabulating about the system that generated those prices. And so a lot of what you see in the financial press is a sort of, oh, yes, no, we got it wrong, but we bumped in, it was just a bump in the road, or it was just this, or it was just, it was the mortgages, or it was the high price of oil, or it was bad government practices. And so people will look for various kinds of explanation to justify the big wobble in the stock market. But in fact, I think we should be using this moment of sort of financial madness to understand that there's something far deeper at work here. There's a far deeper problem than just any one of the number of problems. It's certainly true that there was bad lending. It's certainly true that there was immense greed on Wall Street and a range of other things. I'm not suggesting that those explanations are false, but what I am suggesting is that underlying that is a failure of our imaginations about how we might value the world in different ways other than by surrendering to the market and let prices set the value for us. Because as soon as we do allow markets to enter, we allow powerful organizations and particularly powerful corporations to be able to manipulate those prices and to be able to exclude from those prices the things that we value most, like the future, like environmental costs, like social costs. And what we could be doing is thinking of other ways in which we could value. And in fact, the Nobel Prize in Economics this year was partly awarded to Eleanor Ostrom for her work on the commons. Now, the commons is an idea that we could figure out not only a set of resources, but rules for governing that resource that aren't about submitting to markets. And this may sound fanciful, it may sound like the sort of thing that you have to join a commune to do. But in fact, in a recent study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, over 80 forest communities were examined, and it was shown that those forest communities that did manage their resources in common, and rather than bringing the market in or letting government do it, those communities did much better for their citizens and sequestered much more carbon. In other words, the communities that are allowed to manage their resources in common are not only much more sustainable in terms of carbon and in terms of the environment, but also do better for their citizens. Now, that kind of way of managing resources and valuing resources is a very different way from letting the market rule. But it does involve much more active citizenship and much more active engagement. And that means that we do need to sort of stop being consumers and be much more mindful citizens. And that's one of the things that I argue for in The Value of Nothing.
You mentioned Garrett Hardin's influential essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, which had a strong impact on environmentalists by claiming that commons wouldn't work because one or two selfish people could reap all the benefit and the others would be left holding the bag. And you claim that he had the wrong idea.
Well, yes. I mean, Garrett Hardin wrote beside this sort of think piece in which the term the tragedy of the commons appeared. And the idea is that the tragedy of the commons is that there is a resource that is unowned by any individual, and therefore people will use that resource and exploit it, and they will continue to exploit it, even if they know that collectively they're destroying, destroying that resource in perpetuity. But they can't help themselves, and that's the tragedy, that people with open eyes will destroy something that they know that they depend on because they're driven by sort of primal urges to consume that resource. Now, that's a model that owes everything to the idea of this economic man, of a creature that is driven exclusively by its appetites. But if you look at the history of the commons, if you look at where communities have managed resources together, you'll find that actually communities have managed those resources very well. And you find that communities are able to, for example, as I was saying before, manage forest resources, manage fisheries, manage all manner of natural resources so that they are used sustainably and they are shared equitably. The trouble is that there is an animal that is rapacious, that doesn't really care about the future, that really cares for the short term and for the bottom line, and that creature is a corporation. When you have corporations that are operating on a sort of three-month cycle and they have to report to the markets, then profit becomes really the only guiding motive. And if you look at examples where organizations and individuals have destroyed the environment, even though they depend on it. Invariably, that's been driven by the profit motive. It's not been driven by a collective decision to exploit that land. It's been driven by individual property rights and a desire for profit. So think of the Dust Bowl, for example, in the United States. That wasn't a tragedy of the commons. That was a symptom of industrial agriculture that was becoming ascendant there. And if you look at the big Dust Bowls of the 21st century, again, in China, what you find is sort of central economic planning that has destroyed the environment, not because people have been using up their resources underneath their feet, but because they've been forced to either by the profit motive or, in this case, by government directive. The one thing that you don't find in real commons is precisely the tragedy. The tragedy comes from either capitalism or from sort of central government planning. And that is the weird sort of twist, is that the tragedy of the commons is precisely the opposite. The tragedy is that the commons have been destroyed, either through big government or by big capital.
Our government right now, supposedly democratic, is pretty much hostage to big capital. The two alternatives you give are largely classical Athens and the Zapatistas in Mexico.
Well, I mean, I think what we need to remember is that what we live in at the moment is not really a democracy. But it's more a complainocracy. That's one way of thinking about it. Because the incumbency rates in the United States are so high that it's virtually impossible to get someone elected from a party other than the one that's incumbent. And of course, if you do manage to get someone other than the person who's incumbent, you'll get a party whose policies are pretty much the same at heart, with a little bit more in the way of social conservatism or a little bit less. But what we don't have is a democracy in its sort of classical Athenian sense. And I think people need to remember that in classical Athenian democracy, I mean, with all its warts and slavery and all the rest of it, in classical Athenian democracy, there weren't any elections. What you had was citizens being selected at random, and 6,000 citizens would become the government for a year, and then they would step down, and another 6,000 chosen at random would govern the city. In other words, being a citizen was to be someone who took direct responsibility for your city. And that's a very different system from the one we have right now. I think that should be a reminder of how far we are from democracy. And of course, there are examples where that kind of democracy is still alive today. And you see it in many social movements. Foremost among which is the Zapatista social movement in southern Mexico, in Chiapas. But they're not the only place where you can find these kinds of politics. I mean, you can find them in smaller experiments in Europe. You can certainly find them in social movements and democratic social movements in the United States as well. And I think what that should nudge us towards is a recognition that if we're going to value the world differently, we can't rely on markets to do it for us. We need to actually get active. We need to become better citizens. We need to seize back our imagination about what being democratic might be. And these movements and this history about democracy is something that's well worth remembering if we are to reinvigorate our imagination.
This is Booktown on KBMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. We just heard an interview I conducted about 2 weeks ago with economist Raj Patel about his book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Most of what we talked about were the problems of economic ways of looking at the world. In the next 25 minutes or so, I'm hoping to look in greater detail at some of the solutions. The person involved is Lester R. Brown, who's been one of the major ecological and eco-economic thinkers of the last 20 or 30 years. He was the founder of the World Watch Institute, which puts out its yearly State of the World series. And in the past few years, he's moved over to the Earth Policy Institute, where he's been more solution-oriented and has come out with a series of Plan Bs. It's now in its fourth edition, Plan B 4.0. I was unable to talk with Lester Brown today. He's extremely busy, but I am going to talk for the next 20-some minutes with Matt Roney, who's a research staffer at the Earth Policy Institute and is completely acquainted with everything in the book and everything that the Earth Policy Institute is doing. Welcome to Booktown, Matt.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
The book, as I said, is very... The challenges in this case only covers about 75 pages, and the remaining 230 pages is the response. It goes into great detail about, I'll just list some of the major categories: stabilizing climate, a high energy efficiency revolution, stabilizing climate, shifting to renewable energy, designing cities for people, eradicating poverty and stabilizing population, restoring the earth, feeding 8 billion people well. That's more than we can really go into at one time. But I think I could say that the major thrust is to get rid of the false way we price things. And this is one of the things that Raj Patel was talking about in the first half of the program, that so many destructive processes in our economies are actually subsidized by the people, by the government, and the people who are acting so destructively get to reap the profits without having to pay the price. So repricing goods so that we really know what they cost, is that really the center of Lester Brown's idea?
Well, it's certainly one of the main arguments that Lester gives. In order to reach a sustainable global economy, we really need to have a market that tells the ecological truth. Right now, something like $700 billion per year is spent subsidizing environmentally destructive practices around the world. Just think what we could do with that money if it were put towards things like shifting to renewable energy or energy efficiency. And so the fact that we do subsidize so many environmentally destructive things in this world, it really makes us realize that our path is unsustainable, and that's why Lester has written the Plan B series, recognizing that Plan A, or business as usual, just isn't working, and it's a recipe for disaster for the world. So more accurate, more ecologically based pricing, incorporating indirect costs of burning fossil fuels, for example, into the price of electricity, things of that nature, will help us get there.
For instance, we pay maybe $3 or $4 a gallon for gas, but the real cost, depending on how you calculate it, could be $10 or $20 a gallon.
It's true. One of the recent estimates brought up to current dollars is about $12 per gallon. What the gasoline tax actually should be, if we incorporate the cost of reduced air quality, climate change due to burning fossil fuels and the carbon emissions that result, and that sort of thing. So, in actuality, we should be paying roughly $15 per gallon in this country. One of the things that Lester proposes is raising the gasoline tax incrementally over the next 10 years. It's now about 46 cents per gallon on average in the United States, and what he proposes is raising it 40 cents per gallon per year for the next 10 years, and then we'll see what we do after that. That won't get us close to the $12 per gallon, but it will get us to roughly the $4 per gallon gas tax that prevails now in Europe, where they use much less gasoline, they drive smaller cars, and arguably have less environmental impact in the way they do their motoring. The U.S. Uses more gasoline than next 20 countries combined. So just that figure alone, I think, opens people's eyes to say, well, we can really do things much more efficiently.
The big question, of course, is always the political will, and gas taxes are one of those no-nos in American politics.
Yes.
How do we get over that?
Well, I think one of the main things is explaining it to people, explaining it to consumers, because polls in the United States and Europe show that once environmental taxes are explained to them, about 70% at least of the public are in favor. If you explain it as a revenue-neutral thing, we'll raise taxes on the things that we don't want, such as climate-driving fossil fuel combustion, such as mercury pollution or things of that nature, raise taxes on those environmentally destructive practices and reduce them on work, you know, income taxes, because we want to encourage people to work. We want to discourage these other things. And so once you explain it as a revenue-neutral scenario, people are much more receptive. And that's one of the main problems with how things are framed in Congress right now, is that no one talks about it as a revenue-neutral process. People hear the word tax and it's a non-starter. But if we put that extra component in there, people start to listen.
Now, Lester Brown started out really as a farmer and then as a student of agriculture and then worked for various agricultural organizations, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and international ones as well. And I think that the sort of the crux of his thinking revolves around feeding people. Some of these other, that's the thing that's been worrying him for 40 years, and other worries like climate change have come along more recently.
Yes. You know, he was involved in averting famine in the 1960s in India when he was a member of the USDA Foreign Agriculture Service. And so food and population have been on his mind for decades. But only recently in the fourth edition of Plan B did he really start to think that, like past civilizations such as the Mayas and the Sumerians, that food could be the weak link in our global civilization. But all the trends converging at this point, rising rapid population growth, falling water tables, et cetera, you know, soil erosion from unsustainable farming practices, all these things are coming together in what could be a perfect storm and the collapse of our global food economy. And, of course, that would entail an end to civilization as we know it. And so one of the main things about this book is trying to look at the problems that we face in a lens of food security and to try and see how we can bring ourselves out of that.
A decade ago, he wrote a book called Who Will Feed China? Most people would say, well, the Chinese, they can buy anything they want, but they can't really.
Well, they have been, you know, in recent years especially, you know, they were, it's interesting, Lester just put an article out about soybean production and use around the world and how it's driving deforestation in the Amazon. The interesting story there is that the soybean was domesticated in China about 3,000 years ago or so, and up until the late 90s, they were basically self-sufficient in soybeans. But since then, with rapidly rising incomes and demand for more meat and livestock products that are very grain-intensive, very soybean-intensive, because we add soybeans to the grain feed to increase digestive efficiency and those sort of things. But because of those trends, they now import 70% of their soybean consumption. And so what Lester is thinking about, and one of the problems that we tried to put forward in Plan B, was what if China comes to the world market for most of its grain needs as well? What would that do to world food prices and the stability of the world food economy? Then we kept on looking at it and said, wow, this is a distinct possibility, and it could be very troublesome for the world market.
And what's happening right now is that a number of comparatively wealthy countries, China among them, some European countries, other Asian countries, are buying up huge swaths of land, especially in Africa and South America, where they plan to grow crops to export to their home countries rather than for the people of those countries.
Yeah, this is one of the main concerns that's brought up in the beginning of the book, because it's such a new phenomenon. Some people are calling it neocolonialism. And in some aspects of it, especially the relative secrecy with which these deals are struck, either between governments or between the government of the country where the land is being bought or leased, and you know, major industrial groups from places like Saudi Arabia, like China, and the Middle East countries especially seem to be very keen on this, because they're relatively rich in terms of monetary concerns because of the oil wealth there, but as far as soil fertility and water go, they're not very rich, and so they're trying to compensate for that by buying or leasing these large tracts of land in places like the Sudan or Ethiopia. And what really doesn't make sense about this is that many of the countries in which the quote-unquote land grabs are happening depend on the World Food Program for food lifelines for millions of their people. So it doesn't quite compute that these large tracts of land are being bought up to grow food for other countries when the people in those countries themselves can't get enough food to eat. And so the solutions aspect to this, you know, what do we do about it? Firstly, it's been said by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations that this could be a win-win scenario for poor people in these countries. But that's only if things are done transparently, if the people have a say in what happens to their land, because farmers invariably are afraid of being evicted from their land by foreign purchasers of these tracts. And so we need to make sure that the transfers are done openly, that the local people are involved and are able to reap the benefits of it. Some countries and some companies especially have noticed the outcry against these practices and said, okay, well, what we're going to do first is feed the people locally, and what we have left we'll export. And I think that's what we might be seeing more of in the years to come.
Although at the beginning of the book, he also points out that the number of what Foreign Policy magazine calls failed states has doubled in the last decade. And on his list of failed or nearly failed states, he's got 20 of them that are in pretty bad condition. And they're not necessarily in any position to impose restrictions on foreigners.
That's true. The list of failing states that we follow, that's the most comprehensive and the most holistic, is published in Foreign Policy magazine every summer. And they have 60 or so countries ranked in order of their proximity to disintegration and their instability. The top 20 are really the ones that we look at most closely, because they're the ones most in danger of collapse at some point. And these are social indicators, military indicators. Does the government have legitimacy? What's the level of violence going on in the countries? And so some of the top countries that we see in this failed states list are ones like Zimbabwe and Sudan, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Pakistan, North Korea. And the list gets longer every year, and the scores in this failed states index, when you add up all their scores for the different indicators, how close do they come to, it's not a great name, but a perfect score of 120. There are 12 indicators with a score of 1 to 10. And so how close do they come to that 120? Well, the number of countries that are over 100 points have doubled over the last 4 years or so. And this isn't a definitive trend yet. We don't know exactly where this is going, but the fact that we have so many more countries in that top tier so quickly indicates that state failure is spreading. And so the question is, what do we do to arrest this spread and to heal the countries that are already on the list? And one of the things Lester proposes, in addition to the things that you mentioned earlier, stabilizing population, eradicating poverty, because in many of these top countries, they have extremely rapid rates of population growth, high rates of poverty, and when folks don't have employment opportunities, and they're already competing for scarce resources in very dense populations, environmental concerns go out the window. So we need a concerted global effort to target specifically those countries closest to state failure and to address the root causes of state failure. And these are both natural environmental factors, such as erosion, deforestation, lack of clean water, et cetera, and also the population growth that helps drive those trends. Lester talks about forming a Department of Global Security within the United States government and leading the global effort to really address this failed states phenomenon and the problem, so that we can hopefully take some of those countries off the list.
The last chapter in the book is called "Can We Mobilize Fast Enough?" And the model he puts forth is the total transformation of American industry in World War II, that essentially car production was banned and everything was switched over to planes, ships, and tanks. It was done very successfully in a very short period of time. And I think he argues that we could do that now. But again, mobilizing in one country is one thing. Mobilizing the whole world is a much larger task.
That's true. I think that the United States is in a position to be the example, to show the world that this type of mobilization, this type of movement is possible. But it won't fall just on the United States. I mean, other countries, one of the main points that Lester makes also is that we don't need technological breakthroughs to implement the policies and the actions necessary to get ourselves out of the decline path. Everything that we need to do exists in one or more places around the world, and so what we need to do is find what works best and replicate that around the world. You know, China, we talk about building a coal-fired power plant every week, one or two every week, and yes, that's happening, but what's also happening is they're totally blowing by everyone else in renewable energy. For example, the United States for the last several years was the number one wind market. We installed the most wind turbines of any country in the world, while China went right past us last year, and pretty soon they will have more total installed capacity than we do here. And so things are moving very rapidly, especially on the renewable energy front, which is pretty exciting because that's one of the areas where we need to move most quickly in order to stabilize climate is replacing fossil fuels with renewable sources of energy like wind, solar, and geothermal. Efficiency is also very important, and other countries have put us to shame in terms of energy efficiency as well. One example is Japan, where their program called the Top Runner Program, all of their appliances, the most efficient ones on the market, set the standard for appliance efficiency going on the market the next year. So there's a constant improvement in energy efficiency. And over since the late 90s, they've improved efficiency in all of their appliances by up to 83%. So everything that we need to do is possible, and I think the United States has the ability to lead, but other countries aren't waiting, which is exciting.
But the Copenhagen conference was such a dismal, I don't know if you can quite call it a failure, but it certainly wasn't a success. That's not very encouraging.
No, that's not encouraging, but going into Copenhagen, we weren't very optimistic that there would be a comprehensive or at least sufficient agreement on reducing carbon emissions worldwide. But what Lester sometimes argues, he has argued over the last couple of years, is that these international climate agreements are fast becoming obsolete because there's so much negotiation, there's so much delay, we'll talk about it next year, and that seems to be the story every time we meet. But climate's not going to wait for us. And so nations taking the initiative on their own, we think, are what's going to actually get us out of this situation. The internationally agreed protocols may help eventually once something gets ratified, but countries acting individually seem to be able to enact very aggressive policies. One thing I should mention is that the Department of Energy noted in their data last December that we've dropped in carbon emissions in this country 9% since 2007. Now they predict that this will ramp back up when the economy recovers. However, we have a lot of things in the pipeline, such as new energy efficiency standards, renewable energy, provisions of the Recovery Act, high-speed rail happening, and also a host of other trends that we think will set us on a good path if we build on them. And that's the main point. We can't sit back, and we all need to be politically active as well, because it's clear that politicians won't do anything unless pressured to by their constituents.
What you said, the U.S., you feel, should be a leader or the leader, But other countries are doing substantial things. You mentioned the Japanese appliance efficiency and the Chinese wind turbines and so on. Who else is doing good work?
Well, for example, in Iceland, we haven't talked about geothermal energy yet. In Iceland, you have 90% of the homes there being heated directly by geothermal energy. And that's just one example of a country using its native and renewable resources. And for nearly all of its residential heating. One other example, in China, they have the by far the world's biggest market in solar, hot water, and space heating. Some 27 million solar, water, and space heaters are on roofs in China, and it's just exploding. So for very little cost, folks in villages can get their first hot shower, which is also pretty exciting. The Philippines, something like 19 million people get their electricity from geothermal energy. And one of the most interesting stories is that of Germany, which is generally thought of as a cloudy country, but they have the most solar photovoltaic installments in the world, and that's because of solar-friendly policies implemented by the government. So it's clear that even with local limitations on renewable resources, such as in cloudy Germany, you can still reap great benefits if the policies there are in place.
You say that the politicians will only act if people put pressure on them. What's the best means of pressure?
Well, I think it's partly what we do here, which is getting the word out to the public. We try and reach as many people as possible through, you know, the various media and also on our listserv, because, as I was saying before, you know, when people have environmental tax restructuring explained to them, 70% of them support it in the U.S. and Europe. So it is a matter of increasing the consciousness of these issues and trying to drown out the bullhorn of other special interests, which, as we've seen with the healthcare debate and energy debate so far, is very tough. However, one encouraging example is how coal-fired power plants are being fought vigorously in this country. You know, we know that half of our electricity comes from coal. However, new coal-fired power plants are becoming increasingly difficult to build because of public outcry, not only from people who are concerned about climate change, but also from those in coal mining states, such as West Virginia, folks who don't want to see the tops blown off of their mountains and their streams polluted by the rubble that's indiscriminately dumped in there. And so since 2000 or 2001, more than 100 new coal-fired power plants have been stopped because of the Sierra Club and their efforts at grassroots organizing. And we've also seen financial institutions like JP Morgan Chase and others downgrade coal stocks because they know that eventually we're going to have some kind of a carbon cost coming out of Congress, and they see the writing on the wall, and so they're advising their investors to look at other sources of energy in which to invest. And so these things can happen, and the fact that it's happening in the U.S. on coal is very exciting.
We only have about 30 seconds left. How would you rate the Obama administration, real fast?
They get A's in some areas and not so great grades in others. I think continued support for ethanol mandates and subsidies is not a good move for food prices, and for, you know, the general energy benefit that we get is very minimal. And also the focus on clean coal, I think, is not the right path to go. But their support on renewable energy and making advising their agencies to write the rules on energy efficiency that have been just held in limbo for years under the Bush administration, that's also very encouraging.
This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Matt Roney, a staff researcher for the Earth Policy Institute, about his boss Lester Brown's latest Plan B, number 4.0. Thanks so much for talking with me, Matt.
Thank you, Eric. It was my pleasure.
Okay. And now I'm going to get out of here real fast for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.